Again, good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We, as a lodge, hold two weekly meetings, one on Sunday, of course, from 11 to 12, and then again on Wednesday evenings from 7:45 to 9 p.m. Now, in the room in the front of the building is a library, which is open on Wednesday evenings from 5:30 to 7:30. And also it's not really open on Sunday mornings, but if you get in here at 10:30, I'm sure someone would help you rummage through some of the books to find what you need. Now this lodge, like other lodges found throughout the world, are supported financially and through works of a voluntary nature. Nothing is asked of anyone, only which one feels that he wants to add to this group. Now, on our schedule, we are ending our summer session today, the last of September, and next Sunday we begin a new study in Theosophy and the Theosophical Movement. Now, next Sunday's class will be entitled Ancient and Modern Theosophical Movement. And then in November, we're going to study the Fundamentals of Theosophy. And in December, it's the Cycles and Cyclic Law. Now, all are welcome to participate, but there's no obligation implied or inferred. Now, why do we come together on these 2 days? Well, we endeavor to keep before the world these ideas alive. And they show us that by living a theosophical life, one begins to better understand the world in which he lives. Now, we voluntarily come together and we're voluntarily devoted to the cause of Theosophy. No one is asked to do anything, only what one wishes or feels compelled to do. In keeping these ideas before the public, we like to renew the idea that an understanding of the self will give us a firm and truer realization of universal brotherhood. Now, like many groups, or not like many groups, we do not have a president, a vice president, or we do not have those kinds of delineations of separateness. We are a brotherhood of humanity, and we endeavor to instill in our small group the nucleus of a universal brotherhood. So that ultimately means that we are united in ideas and striving for a possibility of keeping before the world these ideas. Now, we don't think our brain's awake yet, but I know something will happen sooner or later that will wake it up. There is a basis for union among Theosophists, and that is a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. So, as said before, there is no constitution, bylaws, or officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate the idea among the office in the furtherance of unity. So, we as Theosophists regard all those who are in the true service of humanity as Theosophists as well. Well, we'd like to begin our class this morning, and we're taking up the idea of unity and nirvana. I know I forgot something, but we'll give you a chance to ask questions and bring all those things out. But we want to begin by starting, even though our class is on unity and nirvana, we have these ideas held before us. And quite in taking with our subject tonight, or this afternoon, of nirvana and unity, it's the Kuan Yin pledge. Never will I seek nor receive private individual salvation. Never will I enter into final peace alone. But forever and everywhere will I live and strive for the redemption of every creature throughout the world. That being said, we'll keep this in mind and talking about unity and nirvana. Now we begin our class, we're going to be looking at Isis Unveiled, Volume 1 and 2. And we'll read the whole thing, and then we'll open it up for questions. So we'll begin with Volume 2, page 116.
Of all the duties, the principal one is to acquire the knowledge of the Supreme Soul, the Spirit. It is the first of all sciences, for it alone confers on man immortality. And our scientists talk of the nirvana of Buddha and the moksha of Brahman as of a complete annihilation. It is thus that the following verse is interpreted by some materialists. Quote, the man who recognizes the Supreme Soul in his own soul, as well as in that of all creatures, and who is equally just to all, whether man or animals, obtains the happiest of all fates, that to be finally absorbed in the bosom of Brahma. End quote. The doctrine of the moksha and the nirvana, as understood by the school of Max Müller, can never bear confronting with numerous texts that can be found, if required, as a final refutation. There are sculptures in many pagodas which contradict, point blank, the imputation. Ask a Brahmin to explain moksha. Address yourself to an educated Buddhist and pray him to define for you the meaning of nirvana. Both will answer you that in every one of those religions, nirvana represents the dogma of the spirit's immortality. That to reach the nirvana means absorption into the great universal soul, the latter representing a state, not an individual being or an anthropomorphic god, as some understand the great existence. That a soul reaching such a state becomes a part of the integral whole, but never loses its individuality for all that. Henceforth, the spirit lives spiritually, without any fear of further modifications of form. For form pertains to matter, and the state of nirvana implies of complete purification or final riddance from even the most sublimated particle of matter. This word absorbed, when it is proved that the Hindus and Buddhists believe in the immortality of the spirit, must necessarily be intimate union, not annihilation.
Thus, annihilation means, with the Buddhistical philosophy, only a dispersion of matter in whatever form or semblance of form it may be. For everything everything that bears a shape was created, and thus must sooner or later perish, that is, change that shape. Therefore, as something temporary, though seeming to be permanent, it is but an illusion, Maya. For, as eternity has neither beginning nor end, the more or less prolonged duration of some particle of form passes, as it were, like an instantaneous flash of lightning. Before we have the time to realize that we have seen it, it is gone and passed away forever. Hence, even our astral bodies, pure ether, are but illusions of matter, so long as they retain their terrestrial outline. The latter changes, says the Buddhist, according to the merits or demerits of the person during his lifetime, and this is metempsychosis. When the spiritual entity breaks loose forever from every particle of matter, then only it enters upon the eternal and unchangeable nirvana. He exists in spirit, in nothing, as a form, as a shape, a semblance. He is completely annihilated and thus will die no more. For spirit alone is no Maya, but the only reality in an illusionary universe of ever-passing forms.
Nirvana means the certitude of personal immortality in spirit, not in soul, which, as a finite emanation, must certainly disintegrate its particles, a compound of human sensations, passions, and yearning for some objective kind of existence before the immortal spirit of the ego is quite freed, and henceforth secure against further transmigration in any form. And how can man ever reach this state so long as the upadana, that state of longing for life, more life, does not disappear from the sentient being, from the anakara, clothed, however, in a sublimated body? It is the upadana, or the intense desire, which produces will, and it is will which produces force, and the latter generates matter, or an object having form. Thus the disembodied ego, through this soul, undying desire in him, unconsciously furnishes the conditions of his successive self-procreations in various forms, which depend on his mental state and karma, the good or bad deeds of his preceding existence, commonly called merit and demerit. This is why the master recommended to his mendicants the cultivation of the 4 degrees of dhyana, the noble path of the 4 truths. That is that gradual acquirement of stoical indifference for either life or death, that state of spiritual self-contemplation during which man utterly loses sight of his physical and dual individuality composed of soul and body, and uniting himself with his 3rd and higher immortal self, the real and heavenly man, merges, so to say, into the divine essence, whence his own spirit proceeded like a spark from the common hearth. Thus the Arhat, the holy mendicant, can reach nirvana while yet on earth, and his spirit, totally free from the trammels of the psychical, terrestrial, devilish wisdom, as James calls it, and being in its own nature omniscient and omnipotent, can on earth, through the sole power of his thought, produce the greatest of phenomena.
So, what would we, or how would we define nirvana?
except spirit.
Okay. Annihilation of everything except spirit. Is there anything else? Yes.
Is there anything else except spirit? Is that
no? No. Is there anything else that, or any other way we can define this nirvana?
Well, we think absorption is the perfect word, and maybe don't we experience a glimmer of that in a very creative moment or a very loving moment where we're totally absorbed in what is in our mental and emotional state?
Yes, that we do that. But it is in actuality a union with our higher nature. Now, they say Buddha was a nirvani. But are there any distinctions of a nirvani or someone that has achieved nirvana? Does that mean final rest, never to be incarnated again? Or is there what you would call a deeper and a more spiritual way of addressing this? The same as in the Kuan Yin's pledge. How could we be free if all others are in bondage? So what does this sort of mean to us? Yes.
We were co-reading an article years ago, and we think it was Dvaita Advaita and Visishta Dvaita, which meant when you go into nirvana, on the one hand, some believe that you're entirely annihilated. Others, that would be Advaita. Others say that you actually maintain your consciousness. In HPB's article, she's talking about that. And then others say, well, it's a little of both, and that's the paradox, where you're absorbed impersonally, and yet, on the other side of nirvana, there's a whole new manifestation, and you will continue in that manifestation. You will re-manifest with all the wisdom that you've gained prior manifestations. So the interesting thing is, yes, you're fully absorbed and it's completely impersonal on the one hand, but at the same time, it's, we don't want to speak as though we have this figured out, but it seems like you maintain your individuality nevertheless in the next great manifestation. Is that the key?
Yes.
Well, we're thinking the voice of the silence has an entire... What's wrong with words today?
I don't know.
It's me. An entire section on what happens when you reach the point of being able to enter nirvana. You can selfishly choose to do so. And even though it's an earned accomplishment, it is, as you said, wrong to leave those suffering who have no spiritual enlightenment. So nirvana is a choice that the soul can make, and souls like the Buddha did not make that choice, but stayed to help.
The point being that there's a choice. Now, is that choice only at that last moment? Do we wait, and oh, there's nirvana, I'll make the choice now. Is that how it goes?
Humans have the power to self-evolve if they create the conditions within themselves and attain that point or that choice quicker than other, other members of the human family. But that is great because it just gives them greater opportunity to remain certain.
So we're sort of talking about motive here, and our motive is right now as well. We're not deferring our motive until a later time. The motive that we engender during this lifetime is all a part of that final decision. In the back.
Well, isn't it like the dawning of the sun? It's this very gradual process that's ongoing, and then suddenly it is daylight. These tiny moments of choice, these tiny practices of being ethical and kind, leads gradually to this enlightened state.
Okay. Now, is this nirvanic condition is something that we aspire to? Is that something that we want to do? Can you speak up a little bit?
Oh, I've been reading the book of Lao Tzu, and I guess my understanding is when you think about it, it's just this, it's our natural essence. So we don't need to aspire to be it. We just be it, and it comes.
Okay. If we don't aspire to it, to be it, we be it.
Yeah. There are various religious practices around the world that make nirvana the goal. And we think that's the difference of the message of the masters, that the goal is to serve life. And nirvana is the natural result, as was just said, but that's not what you're after. What you're after is being of service.
Right, what you're after is to be of service. In the back?
And isn't the Kuan Yin pledge actually a statement, a vow that the Nirvanakaya would take? That soul, that spiritualized soul that remains operative in order to help the younger brothers gradually bloom through this process.
Yes, we are told that, again, motive, that when nirvana, when we are at the threshold of nirvana, the Nirvanakaya chooses to stay behind and aid humanity. And but those that do not choose that, what happens to them? Are they annihilated, as we're talking about? What happens to them? Are they in a state of bliss forever? Or how do we define this nirvana for ourselves?
The individuals you're speaking of are absorbed, and they are then part of their natural essence. But in returning in the next manvantara into incarnation, they have a huge debt, it would seem, a debt to the rest of life. We can't separate ourselves from anything.
No, and there's never an end to anything. So that the nirvani, as he is absorbed, and we say that he is reabsorbed for an eternity, but we have come to learn in theosophy or in our understanding of cycles that there are many eternities, not just one eternity, and that at the end of our present Manvantara, we are brought back again, either to guide the forces of nature, or to again take up our pilgrimage from the lowest to the highest. So enlightenment is something which we strive for only to benefit others and not for ourselves. So any other questions? Yes.
And the part, the annihilation that they're talking about in the readings, is that the same or is it different than what Mr. Judge talks about in the ocean when the material, the gross materialist over time, his soul becomes annihilated? We weren't quite sure if it's the same.
Well, we're not so sure that the soul becomes annihilated.
Well, there's that separation between,
or I mean spiraling downward,
yeah.
You know, completely with no spiritual or higher aspirations. that the soul does spiral down, but it's always given an opportunity to reclaim its place in the evolutionary scheme of things. But if we are total materialist, we oftentimes are held back for many ages, and then we must reemerge again from the lowest and reattain the highest. So nothing is given to us, but we all have to earn everything. So why do we even discuss this idea? Why do we discuss nirvana? Why? What relevance is that to us as students living in this world where there's so much pain and suffering? What is the purpose of discussing these ideas?
Well, it's, you know, there's so much that says that nirvana is the only reality, and that in nirvana, all is, you know, we are all intimately a unity, and so if the only real reality is the unity that we are, if we hold that in our heads and hearts and act from that basis, then we're probably going to act and think in a very different way than if we thought separation was the reality, when in fact nirvana and unity is the only reality.
Correct. Yes.
But it also represents to the average person, we think, and maybe to many of us, escape. Never again to have a toothache, or a stupid neighbor, or troubles and griefs and the income tax people. We may love life, but we usually hate the conditions. So annihilation, in the sense of nirvana, is a form. Annihilation, in the sense that was mentioned about a materialist, is what you have accomplished, or the things you have created that you take with you, you lose them. So all of your effort has been wasted, but the soul can never be annihilated, not by nirvana, not by its own stupidity.
No.
So nirvana seems to be a beautiful escape.
But is it escape? Is that what the nirmanakaya does? He escapes, but even though he is within the realm of this earth, and he can still aid humanity. Why would that happen? Why would, if you have this, we're in this world of pain and suffering, and why would we give it up? Why would we give up that which we have earned? Well, that is always, that is the great task for all of us, to take up that duty which lies in front of us. And but apparently, this nirvana is a duty as well. Because what happens... What happens to the lives around us as we strive to ever spiritualize our own bodies and our own lives? Do we not affect anything around us, or is it just us who is being affected by all of this, by our effort?
Everything we do affects everything in life, since we all are one. But you asked why the nirmanakayas turn away from nirvana. We think it's very simply love. love for humanity, love for truth, love for duty, love for justice, things we all already feel, we just may limit them. And we might ask ourselves, where would we be right this minute if we didn't have these ideas? And we owe these ideas to the Mnemonikayas. So it's reciprocity as well. We wouldn't have this wisdom without them. Therefore, we seek to serve what they serve.
Yes. As the wheels turn in our mind, something very slowly this morning.
We've heard of a para-nirvana. Do we discuss what para-nirvana is?
Well, can anyone help us out with that? Para-nirvana.
It just means greater than nirvana, but we don't know what that entails.
Yes, well, it means the greater life or the greater existence. But, yeah, go ahead.
Well, isn't that after refusing nirvana many times, there comes a point where you have to take it at the end of the Manvantara? And isn't there like a paranirvanic state there where everyone who has earned it gets a rest, gets to take that?
Well, it's interesting because at every pralaya, at every resting, as the cycles turn, there's a great destruction of all, where everything is reabsorbed back into the one. Now,
there's that absorption again.
Well, but it's absorption to the same extent that we've been talking about it. That it is. We are absorbed, we annihilate it, the personality is annihilated. But when it reemerges again, we reemerge with it. And if it's...
Why would nirvana be different than anything else in life? There's always more. So why would there always be more to nirvana than we could see now? It'd be like saying nirvana plex. You know, there's always more nirvana. There's always more to it.
Well, that takes up the idea that there's never an end.
That's right.
To the journey.
Never is.
And once we have learned what we need in this Manvantara, we take it up again, but on a higher plane.
So that'd be like going from the sixth grade to the seventh grade.
Correct.
Right? And then there's college, and then there's more, and then there's more.
Yes, there is always more. Right. Not that we know what that more is. We are only aware of this existence.
And yet, nirvana is the changeless change, so it's absorption back into that which is beyond description.
Correct.
So that could never be more or less than what it is already. When the student was speaking about para-nirvana, it made us remember a quote about it. The last shall be first. In other words, those that put off nirvana to serve become the para-nirvanis.
Uh-huh.
Something like that.
Yes.
I think it's something good for all of us to look up and research.
Yeah, we think so. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Never will I enter private peace alone.
Correct.
It's a statement of duty to be performed. How does that relate to our discussion of that which is inexplicable?
Well, we are a part of life, and we think that our feelings are who we are, our thoughts are who we are. But when we learn that this world in which we live is this personal world, everywhere around us, everyone deals with a personal idea. So once we step outside of that personal world and look at things as more impersonally, and we become better able to control our own lower natures, and we are actually in charge of ourselves rather than letting life be in charge of us. That what comes to us, well, it comes to us. I'm just going to live life and deal with those things that come to me. Now, the idea is that we become an active participant in life rather than being affected by life. We affect life. And the great struggle is for us to detach ourselves from what we have known to be real. You know, in this world in which we live, where the personal idea is supreme, and that these ideas are not talked about because they have no relationship to that personal idea. Because we live to know, and that is to know who we are. And once we know who we are, or once we begin knowing, it is an ongoing journey. And nirvana is the end of that journey. Now, whether that journey ends in that absorption, or it ends in that deferred, for when this great cycle, this great manvantara is at an end, we have a period of rest, and we again take up this struggle. Yes.
Well, I mean, I guess I see that nirvana isn't really the end, it's just the end of our ability to comprehend the highest state. So once we get to nirvana, we just go, my brain, the human capacity of analyzing and thinking about this stuff, stops at this thing we call nirvana and paranirvana. So it's almost like a move. It's like trying to get a computer to run a program in 1984 that was meant for 2012. It's just not going to work. We'll break down. So I think it's just the acceptance that as far as we are right now at our level of consciousness, nirvana represents the ceiling of our ability to comprehend what we can become. But when we reach that ceiling, the nirvanakayas who are there, they see a lot more, and then they're given the choice. Do you want to continue to evolve in through these higher planes that everyone else cannot understand, or do you choose to take up a job in which you help these people to come reach the level you've reached? And some people say, okay, I want to be that bridge. And other people say, there's enough bridges, I want to move on. But there's sort of a set of natural laws, natural conditions, which guide people to the right choice. And if they don't make that choice, they don't owe a debt. They haven't done anything wrong. They just look at all the information available at the higher plane and say, well, it seems I'm a better fit for something else, so I move on.
Yeah, I think that's well spoken. Yes?
I think, though, in the original writings that we studied, that there is no growth in nirvana, no higher learning.
No.
It is total absorption, which means that you don't have an individual mind to make contrast, or you are it. And we think that's a little different.
Yeah, there is no contrast. We would think that it's very much like Devakan. It's a bliss state. And there is no night and day. There are no contrasts. And that once we have come to the door of nirvana, it implies that our brain cannot really comprehend anything more than that. Our mind cannot comprehend anything beyond that. And if we choose, we go into nirvana and we are reabsorbed. But if we defer, we stand to aid humanity, to help others that are on the same journey.
So the true goal would be the last sentence on page 2. The arhat, the holy mendicant, can reach nirvana while yet on earth. The spirit, totally free from the trammels of the psychical, terrestrial, and devilish wisdom, being in its own nature omniscient and omnipotent, can on earth, through the sole power of thought, produce the greatest of phenomena. So that would be the Nirmanakaya, who remains in that state, who understands the reality of true universal brotherhood, and then can avail these powers within universally for the good of all.
Correct. And do we have an example of that in the history of man? Of anyone who has reached nirvana and has deferred it? Do we know of anyone?
Gautama the Buddha.
Yeah, Gautama the Buddha is perhaps our greatest example.
We've heard the first fundamental principle.
Can you speak up, please?
And the first fundamental principle is a word that always impresses us, and that's called omnipresent boundless principle, which is not subject to any mental concentration. It is beyond the power of subconscious beings to talk about that which is beyond.
Now, could you repeat that again? I'm not quite sure I heard what you said.
The first fundamental principle,
okay,
the omnipresent boundless principle, not subject to thought, but we always begin there and proceed to the second, the universe of all cycles. And then we proceed to the third, the aim and the purpose. So if we consider this principle, this omnipresent, this divine spirit, in the privacy of our own meditation, it's our understanding that that's where we begin. So the fundamental principle, without which, and as HPP said, you would not be able to continue to study these ideas.
Yeah, well, yes, in terms of the fundamental principles, there is but one fundamental principle, and that is unity. And that unity is what we strive to re-become, part of that unity. Right now, we feel that we are separate from all of life, and we are ever trying to comprehend that idea of a unity, that we are all a part of each other and of everything, and that this unity is what every great teacher has, we wouldn't say has strived for, but we remember in the writings of Porphyry and Emblichus and Ammonium Saccas, they talked about Plotinus and about how 6 times in his lifetime he reunited or united with his higher self, and which is enlightenment. He became a knower of all, but in the body. And Gautama the Buddha is another example of that. And we have, you know, the idea of Jesus. That story reverberates through the ages, you know, Jesus of Sargon, of different people with different names, but the same idea is present, of that, of realizing our unity. Ultimately, you know, we which we say to ourselves, yes, we are all united. But when we look out over each other, we see everything is separate. So the paradox is, how do we realize this unity? And the unity that we can best endeavor to understand is in the mind. The mind has to become porous to these spiritual ideas. And by that happening, one is able to begin to grasp that unity, that oneness. This is really a tough subject for getting our minds awake. And we want to say something stimulating, but it's not coming out either.
Well, and is to think about these ideas.
To think about what?
To think about it. We're given teachings, and we're told to think about it. But what we call thinking, we think is skimming these ideas. We have to go inside.
This idea is the one which HPB ever strove to instill in the Western mind, is that ability to think. Because there is not, we don't think. We just accept things, or we hear something said and we repeat it. But the idea of thinking and exploring an idea and ingesting it in our mind and contemplating it, we stretch that muscle, and we have to learn how to think and not simply accept things as true. And that is the first thing that we are told when we come into these rooms. Leave all your previous ideas at the door. Just come in and sit and listen and think about the ideas that are being presented. This is what will free us, the ability to think. In the back.
We've heard the idea that mankind has never been without a friend, that there are those always helping, or behind the scenes at least. Is that the embodiment of those folks who give up nirvana? Are they the ones we're talking about?
Well, man is never without a friend. We go back to the first chapter in the ocean. It's pointed out to us that there are those perfected beings who have come before and who have absorbed all the lessons of life and have risen above them, risen above the pairs of opposites. And through that endeavor, they're able to see reality and live in that reality. Whereas we don't live in reality. We only have glimpses of that reality in our moments of solitude and in our moments of aspiration, of wanting to help. And oftentimes it's the simplest acts that we do that bring us the greatest reward.
You said before we look around and see separateness, not unity. But a student once offered the fact that the differences between us represent, and just physically,
yeah,
represent 2% of us.
Right.
Height, weight, hair color, eye color. 98% of us is identical.
Yes.
And if we then stop and think about thinking and the way we have certain skills or talents, well, that's due to the instrument. even from people who wake up from a coma. They couldn't speak or seem to hear or see, and yet they have a retention of everything that went around them. So the judgments that we make about other people are surface judgments. We should see they are identical to us, using the same powers and the same possibilities.
Yes, and we cannot dispute the fact that we live, the world in which we live in is personal. And as hard as that is to understand, we understand it all too well, because our entire existence is at a personal level. But when we come to theosophy, there's more to be understood that is beyond that personal. And the only way that we can understand that is by being universal in our approach and in our understanding, being more cosmopolitan rather than being narrow in our thoughts and our ideas, but to embrace all of life as a co-creator with nature. Excuse me, we can't hear.
Learning this theosophic perspective of life here, if we're only going to do it here, why even bother if we're not going to leave and do it out in the world as well? So being a student of theosophy isn't necessarily reading all the books in the library, but being a student, you know, studying things that are going on around you and looking at them in a theosophical light. So when we come up on challenges, rather than making some people often make, we can just simply ask ourselves some questions. What is it that I did that put me in this situation? You know, where have we been that we find ourselves with such new opportunities we didn't even expect, you know, and well, if these wonderful opportunities are here, outside the lodge, we must have the powers within us to make the best of it, and so let's get going with it. Rather than some people would look at it and not feel that they're up to the opportunity and not take advantage of the opportunities. And conversely, some people will wonder why did some bad things happen to good people. I don't deserve this. Well, yes, you do. And if you view it through the theosophical, through the light of theosophy, you can see a little more differently and perhaps in a richer way learn what you're supposed to learn so that you can move on, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but it's all a matter of, yeah, we hear about it here, we talk about it here, but do we really learn how to do theosophy or live as a theosophist unless we're actually out doing it? You know?
Well, that is one of our goals, is to make theosophy a living power in our life. And we were often asked by those outside the lodge or this group of why aren't you out there opening up food kitchens? Why aren't you doing something with the poor? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? And the hardest thing for us to do is not change the world, but is to change ourselves. And that's where we need to live, not be concerned about changing someone else's ideas or someone else's way of living their life. But our purpose is to live the life ourselves and let that be an inspiration to those around us. But we always have to remember one thing. The world is changed inside of us first. It all begins with ideas. And that is why the truth is so powerful. Because these truths have never died. They have always existed. Sure, they've become hidden and inaccessible for periods of time, but they always reappear. And what has drawn us here is the truth. The truth that we hear has giving us a vitality for life. Now, the fact of reincarnation and karma, the fact of unity, the fact that we are not separate from anyone or anything, and that we are on a journey. And this journey has a lot of signposts along the way, which are reminders to us of how we can be of better service to humanity.
But coming in and hearing the ideas and even appreciating the ideas is just the beginning. It isn't a, oh, I'm going to go out and I'll be a better person. You might actually be worse in many ways because things get stirred up in you. So we don't think you can judge any other soul by the level that you think they should have because of what they study.
Yeah.
Because there are theosophical Hindus, theosophical Muslims, theosophical
Christians.
Everybody. Everybody
yes.
who lives up to the highest in them.
Yes.
So it goes back again to love. If we love the truth, we'll fight to understand these things and then to use them as we can.
Yes, and again, that word love, that is an idea that binds us together, that is not separate from anyone. Everyone is endowed with this love of humanity.
Well, our society today places great emphasis on competition, whether in sports, in school, in any endeavor, which forces upon our children the idea, I've got to be better than he or she, or I am better than that situation over there. Can we see that that is the direct opposite of what these teachings are saying to us? Competition, aggressiveness?
Well, we know that competition always seems to divide us, not bring us together. That cooperation is the idea for the age. We have to learn to cooperate as lower nature does. Through the cooperation of lower nature, we live. And if it didn't cooperate, we couldn't survive. Each kingdom sacrifices itself for that kingdom above it, and so on and so on. That this cooperation is used to fulfill our obligation. To reawaken that spiritual self, that our cooperation will show us the unity of life, not so much the competition. Well, we struggle through this hour, and we must thank everyone for participating. Meeting adjourned.